Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. For years, law enforcement leaders in our area have been pleading for more resources. The sheriff has complained about overcrowding at the jail. The courts face a backlog of cases. Mecklenburg County DA Spencer Merriweather has echoed those comments and pointed out that while Charlotte has exploded in population growth, the level of staffing in his office has remained almost stagnant. The DA's office hasn't had a significant increase in staffing in nearly 15 years. The recently passed Arenas Law, which went into effect on December 1st, provides money to hire 10 more prosecutors, but that number doesn't match the need and the burden the law's new requirements have put into effect will be felt in that office, at the jail, and in the courts. Critics of the law point to that and the lack of resources provided for mental health treatment as major obstacles to achieving what the law purports to do, increase public safety. But Spencer Merriweather can explain this far better than I can, and that is why we invited him to join us for the hour to talk about his department's ongoing need for more resources, the impact of this new law, and how our various law enforcement agencies can and do work together to make us safer. Welcome back to the program.
Mike, it's good to be with you.
We were just talking off the air about the fact that the first time you were here, I think it was 2017, which is right after you became the district attorney, and you've been back, but not in the studio. So welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
We've supplied you with water.
Yeah, so. Thank you.
Good reason.
Thank
to
you
come.
Very much.
State House, I'm going to begin where in a place I had not anticipated beginning, and that's with Sheriff McFadden. The State House Representative Carla Cunningham, the former Chief Deputy of the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Department, Kevin Canty, and three former Sheriff's Department employees have all filed a petition to remove Sheriff Gary McFadden from office. You have asked the State Bureau of Investigation to look into the claims being made by those individuals. What are those claims?
First of all, let me say I won't be able to get too much into the details, but you've asked a question that I actually have published, and the first claim basically is outlined in the statute for removal of sheriff. First, willful neglect, maladministration. There was a criminal allegation of extortion, bribery, and all of those are items that were listed in the petition that are ripe for investigation by the SBI.
The extortion you're referring to is that she is alleging, Carla Cunningham is alleging, that because she was going to be one of the Democrats who crossed the aisle to vote with Republicans on forcing sheriffs in the state to more closely cooperate with the federal government and their immigration enforcement policies, he made a comment to her that she alleges was a threat. Which we can get into later, but he also the allegations also say that he used sheriff office credit cards to pay for upgrades on hotel rooms and flights, used office vehicles for personal use, weaponized the Internal Affairs Division in efforts to seek retaliation against critics, directed deputies to work at events at Johnson C. Smith University, directed on-duty deputies to take officials in town for a conference to bars and strip clubs, and there are also charges of mismanagement that led to safety issues, including inmate deaths and injuries to staff and injuries to inmates, and there were allegations of campaign finance violations and Hatch Act violations, which prohibit the use of political activities using equipment, office space, and funding from government sources. These are pretty serious allegations.
Not in a place to categorize any of these things, and I don't want to get ahead of the investigation. What I'll say is that that is certainly what's been alleged in the petition, and I believe that the agents from the State Bureau of Investigation we'll investigate it thoroughly. We're going to give them the space to do that. I don't want to step on their actions right now.
This has been brought up before because a lot of complaints over the years have been lodged against Gary McFadden, which he has always denied, and he's made some forceful denials, and he's been on this program several times laying out his case, and he's he stayed in office. And people have said, well, why don't they just remove him from office? But he's an elected official, and there's really no mechanism that we've been told to do so. But clearly there is, because I discover that a little-known law says that any five residents can set this process in motion, and then the district attorney, that would be you, decides whether to present a petition to a superior court judge. You have sent it to referral to the SBI.
Well,
is that the normal course of events for something like this?
Let me break it up just a little bit. Before, and I'm talking generally about the statute, when those five qualified electors submit or file a petition, the easy way to think about it has to be perfected by approval of either the district attorney or the county attorney. So basically, those two people, me, I have to make a decision as to whether that's something that would move forward. A person in that position can't make that kind of decision without some level of assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why typically the district attorney or county attorney would ask for an investigative agency to look at this.
So just in a normal case where, not involving a public official, just a normal case where some of these allegations would be made, maybe with a business person or something, would you outsource that, or is that something that your own investigators and your own attorneys would look into before you decided whether or not to ask for an indictment?
Glad you asked that question, okay. Because that's what makes all this pretty rare. In North Carolina, the district attorney is not an investigative agent.
Okay.
And so typically, law enforcement agencies will go out, investigate cases, charge cases, and then deliver that charge and its evidence to the prosecutor to then go and prosecute. There are couple of exceptions to this. One of them is officer-involved shootings, where the statute expressly gives me the authority to ask for an SBI investigation or ask for someone to another law enforcement agency to go out and investigate it. This is kind of another one where we are the initiators of the charging or the prosecution.
In a written statement about this, you said this, quote, "District attorneys have only rarely granted the approval of such a petition, with the understanding that election of a community's official is a binding choice of the public, which should only be superseded under the most grave circumstances." In your opinion, did the charges being levied against the sheriff at this point constitute grave circumstances?
The charges right now are charges. It is only after some investigation will I be able to answer that question with any sort of intelligence.
Okay. At the federal level, elected officials can be, including the president, can be removed through impeachment. I don't think we have that at this level. There's no impeachment process. So this would seem to be, however, something close to it. Five citizens get together and say, he did this. Get rid of him or her. There have been months of these allegations forthcoming over the last several years from former employees, all denied by the sheriff, about what they characterize as his abusive management style. Republicans in the General Assembly are planning to look into that at a hearing later this month and have feuded with McFadden over just how he handles cooperation with the federal government on immigration matters. McFadden has always said that he has followed the letter of the law and is in fact alleged that they are breaking the law by asking him to break the law. Now these allegations from Carla Cunningham that the sheriff's comments that he didn't want to see her, quote, get hurt by her vote amounted to an attempt to extort her into changing that vote. Whether or not any of these things are true, whether or not a petition is filed to remove him, shouldn't these charges be investigated by an outside source? There have been enough of them over time.
Well, I think that, first of all, in this particular circumstance, because of this petition, it includes a lot of the things that you listed, and it will be investigated by an outside agency. The reason why...
Well, I guess my question is, why has it taken so long to get to this point? There have been sufficient... people coming forward saying this is, and they could all be lying. No question about it. He says they are.
I will tell you that I think the form of the presentation of this of such allegations makes a difference. I will note that the petition includes at least five affidavits, which means that someone actually said this stuff under oath.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there is a particular context that at least a person in my position or a county attorney would have to review to determine whether or not it merits that kind of investigation. And I think it's safe to say that if that had happened earlier, we would be in an investigative posture earlier. It did not. And so now we are where we are.
So we have this sheriff's election coming up, because you're going to be part of that too. You're coming up for re-election as well. So far, McFadden is running in the primary in March against three other Democrats. No Republicans have yet filed, and I don't think they will. But do you anticipate findings from the state investigation or any decision on your part whether or not to proceed with this petition to happen before the primary?
I have no idea. We're going to let the investigation go where it goes. You can run a significant risk by putting a time clock on an investigation. That's the kind of thing that leads to confirmation bias. It's the kind of thing that leads to a rush to judgment. If I'm going to do this job right, if the investigators are going to do their job right, we're going to let it be done right as opposed to worrying about when
this is not dissimilar to investigations into Donald Trump that occurred during Merrick Garland's tenure at the Justice Department, and the clock ran out.
Is that
fair to voters?
Investigations are what they are. I will tell you that I think historically there has been a value that prosecutors have had to observe about making sure that their work does not interfere with the work of the people of determining who they can select to serve them. And so that's something that any investigator has to be mindful of.
But there's a certain amount of urgency. I think we have learned from experience now that there's a certain amount of urgency to this. Voters, yes, want to elect the person of their choice, but their choice may change based on the facts.
The job that I have
cast
upon me an urgency to get it right. And that has to take precedence over everything else. That I have to be able to know that before I make a next active move, that I'm doing that upon truth, doing that upon fact as I believe it. And so I'm not going to, there's no other, course of urgency that's going to make me do anything before I have that level of confidence.
This, as I said, is a little-known process. This has been suggested that this should have happened a long time ago. Some people have said, but there was no way to do it. Clearly, there is a way to do it, but it's little-known, and it's a process that is rare, and which is why it's little-known.
It's little-known in Mecklenburg County. Okay. I will tell you that even within the last couple of years, there have been at least initiations of sheriff removals in other counties in our state. There have also been initiations of other elected officials removal by a similar process. So it's just new here.
How often have these been successful?
Well, I cited two other circumstances. I believe one in a western district and then another one in an eastern district, and both of them the removal processes were initiated and the sheriffs were resigned before they actually made it to a conclusion of trial.
Spencer Merriweather is our guest. He's Mecklenburg County's district attorney. He's been very carefully wading through this because this is a case in progress and under investigation, and the attorneys don't want to put their feet in their mouths. But when we come back, we'll talk about things that you can talk about more openly, I think, and that's the needs that you face in your department and how at least some of those needs may or may not have been addressed by Arenas Law and more. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcltregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Spencer Merriweather is our guest. He is the Mecklenburg County District Attorney. He's been our district attorney for over 8 years. He was first appointed to fill the shoes of the previous district attorney who went on to become the the guest we had yesterday, the Western District of North Carolina federal. What's the title? I can't remember.
U.S. Attorney.
Thank you. He was just here yesterday. Anyway, that was in 17. You were appointed, then you were reelected in 2018 and 2022, and your current term ends at the end of this year, which we have just now begun, and the primary is less than 2 months away, March the 3rd. So far, you have no opposition.
That's correct.
At all, Democrat or Republican. What does that tell you?
It tells me my contract appears to be renewed at this moment.
But why?
Well,
is the question.
You know, look, it's we've worked really hard to try to make sure that we are, going about this work the right way. I don't think that I've made this job look especially easy either. I think this is a especially difficult time to engage in the work of leading an office of prosecutors.
Why?
There's a lot. I think that there's certainly more scrutiny and attention given to the role. I believe that whatever your politics, that a lot of our norms in the justice system have been tested both at the state as well as the federal level. And it's making people ask very central and fundamental questions about what our justice system ought to be. That comes at a time where we haven't necessarily, meaning as a society, we haven't necessarily mined the store very well as far as how we resource it and how we invest in it.
We talked yesterday with the U.S. Attorney from the Western District of North Carolina, Russ Ferguson, a little bit about this and the fact that the Trump administration's Department of Justice and the Trump administration in general has been accused, and I think it could be argued, that they have pushed the envelope when it comes to the law and Constitution and may have stepped over that line many times, and it is testing the legal system. But you alluded to the fact that it's happening here. How so? In the state?
No. Well, I think what I really was alluding to is the fact that the people themselves demand a lot more of the system. Let's go back to the last segment. That people want things to happen fast. It is the nature of our society right now. And you don't, when you're trying to find the truth, when you're trying to honor due process, when you're trying to make sure that you're thinking about balance of power, time isn't a thing. That's not going to come to you in 140 characters. Like that's, these are pots that are on the stove that kind of have to simmer a little bit, and our society isn't necessarily used to that.
From a legal perspective, from a lawyer's perspective, not necessarily the district attorney, but just from what you know as a lawyer, is it healthy to test these boundaries? Some of these boundaries they've been so set for so long, we thought they were set in law. Clearly, they are not. And norms are being challenged. Is that necessarily a bad thing?
Now I'm stepping out of my role as district attorney,
yeah,
if you asked me to. I come from people who were, I myself was raised in Alabama. My parents were both grew up in the civil rights movement and were a part of it. Their world was created by people testing the law and pushing norms. Obviously, those were in ways that I believe to be exceedingly favorable to the society. And I'm sure that in the ways in which we are tested now, there are people who believe that those ways are favorable. I think society's got to kind of work it out. And it is healthy for us to have some of that test, even if it's tremendously scary for people.
Well, it is scary. And I think it's scary for a lot of people, not only because the laws are being tested and the Constitution is being pushed to places it's never intended to go, but the last line of defense is you guys, is the court system, is the judicial system, and they seem to these laws that we thought were black and white seem to be full of shades of gray.
If the way that I talk about the way that I talk about the law seems reserved. I mean, you ended the last segment by talking about lawyer trying to make sure he's not putting his foot in his mouth, and yes, that is true. That's because I am a part of an institution that is trying to be a source of stability for society, that I have to work and be mindful every day of making sure that there are really important conversations that have to happen within a society, but we've got to be sort of above it, and we've got to be a constant. That doesn't mean that a lot of the other stuff doesn't have to happen. And I actually don't think that we are the sort of last resort. I still believe that this is a society of the people, and that the people have to be the ones to move it. They are the kinetic energy to make things happen. I believe that many of the norms that have been challenged and, quite frankly, overturned in the last few years, decade and a half, that results in energy from the people that probably changes some laws, and that ultimately will be how the society we want is achieved.
But it's hard to fight back against things you don't agree with if the system is being increasingly difficult for you to participate in, or if it's set up so that one party is favored over the other.
That's right.
Okay. I had not planned to talk about any of that with you, but we'll talk
Me
about...
Me neither.
We'll talk about the 8 years that you have been in office and how the office, the district attorney's office, has changed over that time. I said at the beginning that you haven't had significant increases in personnel in 15 years.
That's right.
Charlotte grows by 150 people or 137 people. You keep hearing different numbers every single day.
County's grown by 20%.
Okay. So put all these numbers into perspective. You haven't had a significant increase in staffing, but the population has exploded. What does that mean?
It means that we don't have the tools necessarily to run the race that we've been asked to run. That it's not just about population. The population is a great is a lot of it. It's also that the job has changed around us. Technology has made it so that more is demanded of us. When we review a case now, we're not reviewing paper or even videos. We're reviewing phones and everything that's in a phone. Phones are what is allowing us to solve murder cases and allow us to prosecute murderers and rapists. And that is something that has increased the burden on law enforcement and prosecutors far beyond just the fact that we've grown as a community. And yet the way that our system is, we haven't kept pace with that.
Let me throw some numbers out here to put things in perspective. Under District Attorney Peter Gilchrist, who is your predecessor's predecessor.
That's right.
This goes way back.
Yes.
Between 1975 and 2010, the number of prosecutors working in the Mecklenburg District Attorney's Office grew from 14 to 80, with a support staff increasing from 2 to 55. It's hard to imagine 14 DAs and 2 support staff, but even in 1975.
That's right.
But that made this department the largest district attorney's office in the state. Since 2010, only 5 additional prosecutors have been added to your staff with the same number of support personnel as 1975 or whatever it was, in spite of the population increase. Are you still the largest DA's office in the state?
We are. It's important to note that, for instance, in the last 5 years, we've had a hard time filling the 85, that at our worst, we were operating with about 72.
Why?
A lot of reasons. One, what our economy was like during COVID. There's not a lot of people who were really excited about doing a really hard job. And so a lot of my work has been going to the law schools, convincing people about just what we talked about, why this is a really necessary part of making society better. We've had some success. Also, as Charlotte has grown, it becomes a more competitive place to keep lawyers in a public service office.
Yeah.
All these tall buildings, they have a lot of money in them, and that money's not going to prosecutors. It's going to people doing other stuff. And so we've got to sort of compete with that. That has been tremendously hard.
Per capita, when you look at the size of our city and the size of your department, how does that ratio compare to other urban district attorney city sizes, et cetera, not only just in North Carolina, but around the country?
Very badly. It is.
I love the expression on your face.
Yeah, when you consider the fact that not only when you match us up with other jurisdictions, but also what we do. A lot of big cities, they actually have the DA's office that handles the felonies and has a city attorney that handles the traffic cases and the misdemeanors. Mm-hmm. We handle all of it. Some of them have offices where someone else handles the juvenile cases. We handle those too. Oh. So we're doing more work with less people serving the same amount of people.
So IRENA's law.
With less money, by the way.
With less money.
Yes.
And IRENA's law went into effect on December the 1st. Among the things that it does, it provides funding for 10 more prosecutors. Not enough. How many is enough?
Probably about 30 more. But let me say that I'm happy for the 10. And that right now my focus has been both filling the positions as well as trying to make sure that there is some level of I can demonstrate some return on investment. It allows for some creativity. We talk about some of the issues in Uptown and having a couple of prosecutors who can deal with some of the, specifically with a lot of the Uptown quality of life issues and in some other neighborhoods across the city as well that may not necessarily have gotten as much attention when we're dealing with, you know, smaller staff. Now I've got a little bit of room.
The state budget, which has yet to be passed and doesn't seem to be moving anywhere any quickly because of disagreements among Republicans in the House and Senate in Raleigh, contains money, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, for 10 more prosecutors. Would that give you 20 if the budget is ever passed, or is that to fund the 10 that is passed through IRENA's law?
I believe that with the passage of IRENA's law, they saw a level of urgency about that particular provision. So I'm not necessarily hopeful for getting an additional 10 if a budget passes within the next few months. I believe that they took that provision and put it in IRENA's law to make sure that we at least got what we needed.
So let's clearly, having not enough people is a burden on you and the people in your office. But talk about what it means to the criminal justice system, to victims, to people on public safety. Is it hurting public safety?
Absolutely, because the larger the caseload, the more badly your time is divided among your cases, and you can't get to have the sort of intensive conversation with victims that you want to have. You want to make sure that you're giving an attention to go through all those phones and all those body-worn cameras and all those other pieces of digital evidence that are necessary. You know, let me take for a minute, though, and say it's not just prosecutors. For instance,
yeah, we're going to get to that.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Just say that, you know, it's judges, it's even public defenders and, like, indigent counsel. Because imagine how hard it is for me to schedule trials if I've got to divvy them up among the 8 or 9 people who are on the list to represent people charged with serious crimes. We have a public defender's office. So 4 people rob a bank, they can only represent 1 of them. The other 3 have to come from that list of indigent counsel. And you start running out. And then a lot of those folks are practicing in Union and Cabarrus and other places as well. And that creates its own burden on our folks.
Mm. What is the wait time for murder cases and things like that right now to get to trial because of the lack of resources?
Right now, we're trying homicide cases from 2019-2020.
Because at one point, the wait was 3 years, then it became 4, and you told, in July of last year, you told WCNC-TV that you had, quote, every expectation that it will become a 5-year wait. It already has.
That's right. That's exactly right.
There is a perception on the part of a lot of citizens that Uptown Charlotte and certainly the transit system is risky at best, unsafe at worst. Is that an accurate perception?
I have ridden and do ride Uptown Transit with a great deal of safety. It's not like I have any armed guards or anything. I have the same safety as everybody else. But I also understand that people, are walking around our Uptown spaces with a great deal of vigilance. There's no question that there's more people who are positioning themselves stagnantly in Uptown. That can be a concern for families that are just looking to enjoy the space, for people that work Uptown. You know, and that's one of the reasons why we've decided to dedicate more of our resources to giving attention to the crimes that are committed there.
Because CMPD has used the word perception in referring to public safety. A person's perception is their reality, but the use of that word by officials makes it appear that they are saying that we may be safer than we think. Are we?
Yeah, I don't like to. It's hard to use numbers when you're talking about safety, because safety is how you feel.
Right.
And I am in a different perspective, I think, than a lot of other people in our system, because the cases I get are ones that have victims, which means something went wrong. And so when I'm dealing with someone who is had something go wrong in their life, I'm not meeting them with statistics because they could care less. I'm just trying to fix the thing that went wrong.
This concern over safety really hit the boiling point with the murder on the Blue Line of Irina Zarutska, the Ukrainian immigrant, by a person she never interfaced with and did not know. Complete random act of violence back in August. Then in December, there was another stabbing on a train. That gave rise to calls for more security on the transit system in particular and the city in general. Can we really protect ourselves against random acts of violence? And is this a societal problem? Is it a law enforcement problem, insufficient resources? Is it that we're too lenient? Is it we don't have enough resources in other areas to help people who get themselves into these situations? What's the crux of it?
What I'll say is that in a place like this that's growing, that is where its growth is exploding, you've got to make sure that you have what you need to serve a place this big. And if you're going to have things, really important things like mass transit, and you're going to have really important things like vibrant central business districts, then you've got to make sure that you've got the infrastructure in place to uphold public safety and the rule of law. I think that we've got a lot of growing to do. Our infrastructure has a lot of expansion to do. We've talked about the DA's office. We certainly have a lot of room to grow, and I hope we get there.
So essentially, we are operating the Charlotte of 1970 in 2026.
I'll give you 1990.
Okay. I'll have to look in the history books to see what that's like. Right. Spencer Merriweather is our guest. He's the Mecklenburg County District Attorney. More to talk about in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Spencer Merriweather is with us. He's Mecklenburg County's district attorney. We were talking about understaffing and the fact that Irina's law will give you 10 more prosecutors, but that law also makes other changes that may increase the burdens on those additional prosecutors. It disallows unsecured bonds as well as written promises to appear in cases where the defendant is considered to have committed a violent offense. In other words, those folks stay in jail. They don't get out on bond while awaiting trial. But to the best of my knowledge, the law doesn't provide funding or resources for our already overburdened jails or our already overburdened courts, and doesn't provide anything. This is one of the things that critics of the law have really pointed to, and that is no mental health money for mental health treatment. What's your view of all this?
If you look at Irina's law and look at let's deal with the things having to do with pretrial release or bail.
Okay.
It's what people expect. Most people would expect, oh, wow, if you shot somebody, you probably ought to stay in custody.
Mm-hmm.
Or that we ought to make sure that we know where you are. If you rob somebody at gunpoint, we probably need to know where you are. If you've done something like this before, oh, man, you probably ought to be in custody. So those are the things we expect. We also say, oh, if you let them out, you probably should write it down and say why, so we can figure out exactly what your thinking was. Irina's law does that. That makes sense. There are a lot of things that are unfunded. For instance, there are certain conditions where it calls for electronic monitoring, and we are very fortunate that Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department invested in that, a long time ago. It's rare among law enforcement agencies across the country. Most times it's a court system. Expressly, this law says that, well, the court system doesn't have to pay for it, which is to say the state doesn't have to pay for it. but you local districts, you guys got to figure it out. Right.
Yeah.
So that's something I think you're going to hear more about. The investment in mental health, I'm giving people some grace on that one because I believe that I've heard from people in both parties that they want to do a deeper dive and know there's a lot more work to do in the area of mental health. I know the speaker has convened a task force to look at that in particular, and I am looking with a lot of hope to see what they come up with.
This new law also, judicial officials must now consider a defendant's entire criminal history, not just convictions, when setting release conditions. What do you see as the impact on the system? Is it simply going to clog it up more than it already is?
I don't know, to be honest with you. Quite frankly, you know, there would be times where I would raise the history of arrests with a judge, and then sometimes the judge would object to that. Sometimes the judge wouldn't. It might be relevant for somebody to know that someone's been arrested 32 times. For instance, let's say a domestic violence case where someone has actually been arrested for domestic violence 10 times, but that's resulted in 10 dismissals because the prosecutor didn't have the evidence that he needed because the witness wouldn't show up because they felt like they couldn't. I might very well want to tell the judge, hey, they've been arrested a lot of times, but they haven't been convicted. And Your Honor, this is what we believe. I believe that is a relevant basis upon for a judge to determine how best to ensure the safety of the community.
This law also creates a new category of, quote, violent offenses. It goes on to specifically define those offenses. How much broader are these definitions than what prosecutors and courts have been dealing with in the past?
There's about four different ones, four different definitions within the statute for violent offenses. Let's start first with a couple years ago. You'll remember that Chief Jennings and I championed the Pretrial Integrity Act, which was, it was just sort of a trial, to be honest, to say, let's make sure that for these offenses, attempted murder, murder, robbery, rape, other things, that we know those cases have to go to judges, not, and bonds can't be set by magistrates. They have to go to judges, have to be considered in open court. That was important. They've expanded this to what we refer to as A through G felonies. That's everything from, you know, murder to assault on a government official inflicting serious injury, or assault by pointing a gun, inflicting serious injury, or assault with a deadly weapon, inflicting serious injury. It is expansive, but again, I think it's what people expect. You'd be surprised, or maybe you wouldn't be surprised, the number of times where I tell someone about a assault that occurs, and I'm like, oh yeah, but that's just a misdemeanor. And they're like, what? That person ought to be, we don't want that person walking the streets.
Right.
And I think this gets folks a little closer to what they already expect.
This law came together very quickly.
Sure
in
did.
The aftermath of Irina's Zaruzka's murder. And it does a lot of different things, including giving you money for more prosecutors. But did anybody in the legislature talk to you, to DA's offices, to sheriff's departments, to police chiefs, to anybody, to the court system, about what they thought this law should contain?
I think I was among a number of people that found out what was in this law when it was printed.
How do you explain that? I mean, you're the experts. You're on the street with this every day.
Well, I'm the expert in what goes on in criminal court. I'm not the expert in what goes on in general assemblies and legislatures. I think that I am a congressional staffer from way back, and I think this is just the way things go now.
So does this law make us safer?
I think that it has the good intentions of making us safer. There are some values in here that I agree with. Like everything, it's a little incomplete.
Because if you have more prosecutors and therefore can handle more cases, you can't bring those cases to trial if the courts have no additional judges or courtrooms, etc.
Which is why I say that it's incomplete.
Okay. In the past, I believe that we've had conversations about the bail system. And these are misdemeanor bail system, where you have advocated, correct me if I'm wrong, for people to have cashless bail in certain circumstances. Am I right about this?
Not exactly.
Okay.
I want to make sure that what's keeping, and I've said this and I've been consistent about it. Whether someone is in custody or not shouldn't depend on like how much money they have. It should depend on what they did.
Right.
And so if you've got someone who, you know, we talked about the person who has interacted with the justice system 30 odd times, you know what? It might be that that person needs some sort of interruption and break and they need to remain in custody. And it may be that that day, mm-hmm. all they did was something that most people consider to be really small.
Yeah.
But they did it 32 times. And so now's the time. But I don't want the person who literally just kind of made a mistake. And that person, it shouldn't be the $5 secured bond that keeps them in custody.
And the reason for that, yeah. and we've talked about this in the past, is that for those people that you just referred to, right. a stint in jail can be life-altering. They can lose their job, they can lose their housing, they can lose their families, all for something that they might ultimately go to trial on and be found not guilty of. But they paid the price anyway.
That certainly can be true. So, it also can be true that the conduct that they've engaged in can change in a pretty serious way the quality of life for the people that they've affected.
Okay. So how successful has this approach been, in your opinion?
I think that you don't want to it's important to make sure that you're capturing a lot of values in how you make your decisions. So it is good that people are thinking holistically about what happens to people's lives. What we don't want to have happen, however, is that people lose a sense of thinking about how the conduct affects the quality of life of a community.
Because I remember talking to you in 2017 about one of your goals at the time, and that was to pay attention to victims.
Yeah, that's right.
And set up mechanisms for victims to be addressed appropriately.
That's right.
That seems like a real tight wire to walk when you're trying to help victims, but also being reasonable with people who have not committed violent, serious offenses.
It's also, you know, I think we all learned that it's not necessarily as easily bifurcated, because a lot of times the people who will find their way in the justice system as defendants have often also been victims. That if, yeah. depending on how they are treated and depending on how they are exposed on either side of our system, it can trouble them when they land on the alternative side.
And so, to be clear, you have been advocating for this for nonviolent crimes, not for people who accused of committing murder or stabbings on the blue line, etc.
And one-offs, which is to say repeat offenders are a different thing too.
Right.
And so that's where I've been wanting to make sure that, and I quite frankly, I think that there's a lot of consensus on that topic, that when people who have just simply made a mistake, you know, those aren't the people you want to occupy jail space with. It's the people who are repeat offenders and people who committed violent crimes.
So magistrates who decide on pretrial detention have been blamed in some of these instances for releasing people who pose a threat to themselves and to others by just letting them go or not sending them to mental health for evaluation. And sometimes offenders who are in the jail, who are in the system, receive deals from your office simply because you don't have the resources to prosecute them. I'm paraphrasing here. Is there a good answer? You can explain that more fully from your point of view.
You saw my face, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Okay. Is there a good answer to either of or both of those problems that would make the community safer? And when I say that you sometimes can't prosecute because you don't have sufficient resources, so you make deals with people, isn't that true?
No.
Okay.
Certainly resources are a part of it, but the main thing that dictates outcomes as far as like what our plea offers, for instance, are.
That's a deal.
Call it a deal if you'd like. But what it is that it's based on an assessment of where our evidence is. The truth is that there's evidence that is stronger in some cases than it is in others. And we are faced with a choice of, well, we can go to trial on this one. And yes, we face a significant chance that of acquittal, which means that this person will have no accountability whatsoever. Or the defendant can also take some risks and say, well, they could be convicted and suffer the ultimate penalty. Or we can both be honest about what the strengths and weaknesses are in this case and then find something that allows for some accountability and also, you know, mitigates the offer somewhat. And I know that can be an unhappy decision, but what our folks are trying to do is make sure that the community is kept safe and that people don't walk out of our court system when we believe they did something and are found not guilty.
The other, we haven't talked about this on any program that I can remember, the other aspect of not fully funding mental health has other effects that are not good. You say that some defendants who are remanded to mental health facilities may stay there for years while the court waits for them to reach a mental capacity deemed sufficient to be able to stand trial, which is only fair. But then the judge sometimes dismisses the cases, which ends up in the release of people who might cause harm to themselves or others. How frequently does that happen?
Certainly too frequently for people who've had a family member that they've lost to murder. I think IRENA's law does tinker with that a little bit, where it tries or at least attempts to connect the person who's been found incapable to proceed, and it connects them to then the involuntary commitment process in a more in a clearer way to try to give those families and, quite frankly, our community a greater sense of comfort and protection than what we've currently enjoyed.
So IRENA's law restarts the death penalty. It never went away. It just was not being used in North Carolina. Russ Ferguson, the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina, was on the program yesterday. I asked him if he viewed the death penalty as a deterrent or merely as the ultimate punishment for a heinous crime. He sees it as a deterrent, even in cases of random crimes. What's your view?
I'm not making a characterization on the death penalty, because that's got to come from the General Assembly and, again, from the people.
As the district attorney, you have the right to ask for the death penalty.
I do, and I believe if I had to choose, I'd probably pick the former alternative, which is to say it is the ultimate crime in our statute. And I have to be willing to consider that for the most heinous crimes.
Is it a deterrent in your mind?
I don't know.
Okay. So then what's the purpose of it?
The purpose of it is that if...
Purely punitive.
Yes.
Death penalty cases can take a very long time to prosecute and a very long time for the person who's been prosecuted successfully to be executed. It takes years and years and years. Given our already overburdened courts, is the restarting of the death penalty likely to become just another burden on the system?
I don't know. We know that even with IRENA's law, there are still going to be a lot of legal challenges to the death penalty that will still persist. What we frequently are in the position of telling families is, listen, this is a possibility, but we also know that there is never really a sense of finality on death penalty cases because of how the system is set up for them to be challenged. There's an automatic right of appeal to the Supreme Court, that there are entire sectors of law around what's referred to as post-judgment relief on death penalty cases. So we know that family that very well may hear a death penalty verdict in court, that they could be looking at the next 20 years of waiting for what they believe to be finality. You know, I believe that the life without parole is certainly a serious penalty as well. We should pause on that for a second. Mm-hmm. There were 10 people in Mecklenburg County Courts who were convicted of first-degree murder last year who received life without parole sentences. We have truth in sentencing in North Carolina, so I have every expectation that those sentences will be served out. There also are a number of people on death row who are awaiting that and have been awaiting that for as long as I've been in office and even longer through the term of my predecessor. And those families who heard of a specific outcome are still waiting. Only time will tell is whether the changes in the law will bring that to bear.
We have run out of time. I was going to ask you what you see as your biggest achievements in the 8 years you've been in that office and what your goals are coming up, because you are most likely to be the district attorney going forward because you're running unopposed, which says a lot. It also says a lot that Andrew Murray, your predecessor, was a Republican, and he recommended you, and you are a Democrat.
There I am.
Well, Spencer Merriweather, thank you for the hour. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.
Spencer Merriweather is Mecklenburg County's district attorney.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.